If they ever stopped to look at their copy and see the word ambitious was there and realize how much of a nothing burger it was, it's worse than interesting and saying nothing about a candidate.
As election 2016 coverage kicks off, candidates are already being crowned by signature adjectives. From WNYC in New York, this is On the Media. I'm Brooke Gladstone.
And I'm Bob Garfield. Bystander videos can shed light on police brutality, but be careful. Your right to record cops is not always guaranteed.
Don't interfere in what the police are doing. If you're recording, make sure you're recording at a safe distance.
And what's being served at the White House Correspondents' Dinner? And what isn't?
It's not really about access. It's not really about correspondence. It's not about scholarships. Most people don't necessarily find it that much fun.
But the shrimp. Oh, the shrimp. Stay tuned. From WNYC in New York, this is On the Media. I'm Bob Garfield.
And I'm Brooke Gladstone. 2016 horse race coverage got underway this week with reporters galloping after Hillary Clinton's campaign mobile.
You can see the media running behind me here to chase the Scooby van.
Guy in the orange pants is pretty quick.
As HBO's John Oliver noted, this week's much-anticipated and over-analyzed video announcing Clinton's official candidacy showed a heap of Americans just like you, and one who was definitely aiming to be.
I'll save you the time of watching this video. It's 2 minutes, 18 seconds long. It features one dog, one cat, and exactly four relevant words.
I'm running for president.
That's it! There is nothing else to see and nothing else to talk about. Because, let me be clear, speculating over who's going to win the 2016 election now is like speculating over who's going to win the shot put at the 2016 Olympics. The only thing we know for sure is that Ted Cruz isn't going to win either.
That's a bit categorical, wouldn't you say? But that won't stop the media from pursuing Ted Cruz. That's what they do. How then to rein in the unbridled enthusiasm of the political press? When the junior senator from Texas announced his candidacy 2 weeks ago, David Leonhardt, who edits The Upshot for The New York Times, wrote that it's the duty of sites like his to point out when a candidate just isn't going to win.
If what you care about is who's going to be president, Scott Walker, Jeb Bush, Marco Rubio are in by far the strongest position. That is what people in politics are actually talking about. That is what members of the media are talking about in their own newsrooms. I don't want the media saying, well, readers, actually, we can't trust you with that information. We don't want you to know what historians and political scientists and pollsters say about what we already know about this election. I want some of my coverage to be honest in that way, and that is what we're aspiring to do.
Do you worry about the ultimate chicken and the egg question? Can you have a candidate without media attention? Even if the media can't make a candidate win, can they, by ignoring a candidate, ensure that they'll lose?
I think history argues really strongly against that. Voters have many chances to make decisions about candidates. Parties have many chances about who they put forward and who they don't. And I don't think the media can squash out a candidacy by paying too little attention to it. If Democrats really want Martin O'Malley to be the nominee, they can start telling pollsters and they can start showing in different ways that they're excited about Martin O'Malley.
But you're ignoring what seems to be some received wisdom that people aren't going to know anything about Martin O'Malley unless he is covered to begin with.
Yes, but if you think about the history here, we in the media have showered attention on unlikely candidates, showered attention on people like Michelle Bachmann, on people like Dennis Kucinich, right? None of those fringe candidates have ever emerged to get the nomination.
At this point in the campaign, when Clinton was running for the first time, he seemed unlikely to win. Would The Upshot have declared Clinton an unwinnable candidate?
I mean, it's easy with the benefit of hindsight, but Bill Clinton would have been a candidate that we would have said had a serious chance of winning that nomination, particularly because there was no strong front runner. The Republican field in 2016 is vastly stronger than the Democratic field was in 1992. In many ways, Marco Rubio is actually the most similar candidate to Bill Clinton, a young, promising politician who will need to come from some amount of obscurity in order to win the nomination.
The horse race fundamentally is easy to write about. compared to actually using these candidates as kind of political pack animals to talk about issues. I mean, even if Cruz is a long shot, maybe he has an issue that needs to be aired. You could use him that way.
There are certainly ways in which candidates like Cruz can really affect the debate in ways that do matter. So again, as a reader, I want stories about Ted Cruz and about his announcement. I also want stories telling me that, hey, you know what? He doesn't have nearly as good a chance as a series of other people. And even if you say, look, there aren't 10 Republicans with a really good chance of winning the nomination. There are 3 or 4. That still leaves you with a vast array of really fascinating stories. It lets you in the press cover the real battle that's going on among Walker and Bush and Rubio and others to get the nomination.
Covering so many election cycles as I have from a sort of meta-media point of view, I don't mean to oppress you with what sounds like a primal scream, but everything is stacked up to talk about money and perception. And that's it. That is it. It never gets more than a nanoparticle deep into actually what ails our political system.
Well, one of the reasons why I actually am in favor of making these distinctions is I would much rather read stories that distinguished between the tax policies of the candidates who actually have a serious chance of winning than I would yet another story about a candidate like Ben Carson who has virtually no chance of winning.
But you won't read those stories because they won't be written.
Oh, no, they will. They will. We will write them. We will do those stories as well as the other stories. One of the great benefits of modern media is the upside of the cacophony. That if all you ever wanted to read was stories analyzing the policy positions of the candidates, you could do that.
You were talking about journalists using their judgment. You've likened it to covering extreme weather.
Rather than saying either we're going to forecast a 10-inch snowstorm or we're going to tell you it's not going to snow, I think it's more honest to say to people, there's a much better chance that it's going to snow in New York than there's a chance that it's going to snow in California. And I liken that to where we are in politics. There is a vastly, vastly, vastly higher chance that the Republican nominee will be Jeb Bush, Scott Walker, or Marco Rubio than that it will be Ted Cruz, Ben Carson, or Rand Paul. And I think that saying that to readers without going so far as to saying there is no scenario under any situation, no matter what, in which the nominee will be someone other than Jeb Bush, Scott Walker, and Marco Rubio is a way to level with readers and to be honest with them about what we know and what we don't know.
David, thank you very much.
Thank you for having me.
David Leonhardt is the editor of The Upshot, the news and data analysis website from The New York Times. As candidates emerge fresh and sleek from their campaign caves, the naming has already begun. It's an ancient tradition dating back at least as far as Homer. Our heroes may contain multitudes, but we make do with shorthand. Achilles the lion-hearted, Athena the tireless one, man-slaughtering Hector, or, more appropriate to the current moment, Thersites of the Endless Speech. New York Magazine's Jamie Fuller has been cataloging the epithets journalists are coining to encapsulate our current crop of presidential aspirants. She started by noticing that Jeb Bush has been dubbed an introvert.
I'm like, huh, this is a kind of a strange word to apply to someone who wants to be president. I went to Nexus, I typed in Jeb Bush an introvert. Lo and behold, there were at least 10 instances in the past decade when he's been called that. And interestingly enough, Jeb Bush was the first one to do it, so we are all doing his bidding when we call him an introvert.
And why do you think that is? Is it because introvert suggests sincerity and smarts?
I think so, and especially when you're a presidential candidate, you want to signal that you're different from everyone who's already in Washington and that you're going to go in and give the place some new blood. And if you're successfully portraying yourself as someone who's not a political type, that's a great way to endear yourself to the public.
Wouldn't it make more sense to dub him the ideological Bush because he's more driven that way than either his brother or his father? I mean, that's useful information.
The one thing that I've noticed out of all of the words that have kind of attached themselves to the candidates who are already running is they have very little to do with their policy preferences.
So introvert was picked by Jeb himself and then picked up by the rest of us. What about Rand Paul?
Very early on, he was dubbed the most interesting man in Washington. One after the other, there were two magazine covers. People from Bill Maher to Barack Obama have all called Rand Paul a very interesting man.
And he seems to like it, too.
He did. The day before he announced his presidential campaign, he put out a video. And the first person that speaks in the video is Candy Crowley on CNN. And she says that Rand Paul is one of the most interesting men in politics.
It's so weird, though. I mean, I always think of interesting as kind of an avoidance word. You know, when someone says something that makes no sense, you say, interesting.
The other word that I'm sure you'd find a lot of if you search through Rand Paul coverage is that he's also different. But I'm sure that if you asked any voters, even some that have been paying attention a little bit to the election, they wouldn't be able to tell you why Rand Paul is different.
You know, you could say slightly modified libertarian. Interesting is about as meaningful as the other word that I hear applied to him a lot, which is curly-haired.
Yes. These words glom onto the candidates and they stick with them the rest of the race, even though they may change a lot.
I was thinking about John McCain, who clung to the term maverick long after he'd recanted most of the positions that had made him one.
And what you see happening to Rand Paul, even at the very early stages of this race, is that he's becoming less of a slightly modified libertarian and more like the other candidates. The further you get in a race, it's kind of inevitable that candidates who once appeared very different will become more similar, and the candidate who ends up winning the nomination is going to have a similar set of policy proposals.
Ted Cruz, what do we call him?
He's been very successful in having people call him the adjective that will help him most in his campaign. He's the conservative candidate. And if you look at 2014 campaign ads in Republican primaries especially, you will not see a single one where the word conservative doesn't pop up on the screen. It was the adjective that everyone desperately wanted and the one they needed, they thought, if they were going to win the primary.
What about Hillary?
Polarizing. That's definitely one that's been used a lot for a long time. And the other one is inevitable. I'm sure that the candidate cringes every time they hear it, and they're clearly trying to downplay expectations. It's just the worst thing that can possibly be attached to your name before a presidential election.
Now, Marco Rubio, you've observed, actually has three words attached to him, and they are
youthful, charismatic, ambitious.
All these guys are running for president, So they're all, by definition, ambitious.
That's the one where you can just tell that people are doing this unconsciously. If they ever stop to realize how much of a nothing burger it was, it's worse than interesting and saying absolutely nothing about a candidate.
Even youthful is a little dubious. I mean, Ted Cruz is, what, 5 months older? I think it's just that Marco Rubio has the best skin.
Yes. And when he announced on Monday, he said that he was the only candidate who could speak for the future and drilled home how much younger he was than Hillary Clinton, picking out candidates and saying, like, oh, when they started doing this, I was in high school. And he definitely sees that as something he wants to stress.
Do you have any words for Scott Walker?
If you look at Scott Walker, Bernie Sanders and Jim Webb, Martin O'Malley, Bobby Jindal, Ben Carson, most of the country has no idea who these people are yet. And we're going to watch in real time as adjectives get added to their name.
Chris Christie has been called brash.
I was thinking that word when you said it.
And Martin O'Malley, the only thing I've ever seen attached to him is relatively unknown.
Yeah, no, not the one you want to have attached, especially if it's going to be attached for the entire election cycle.
You know, reporters hate to change these labels. And I think it's because once you give it up, you have to write a whole new narrative for the candidate. That's a lot of work.
Oh, yeah, no, definitely. It is easier to track things when you stuff everyone in these holes and can watch them progress without altering too much. The one time when you definitely see the words used to describe politicians change is when they go from the campaign trail to being someone with actual political power. It's kind of remarkable.
Can you give me an example?
George W. Bush, his campaign word was the compassionate conservative. That's not what he'll be remembered for.
Jamie, thank you very much.
Of course, thanks for having me on.
Jamie Fuller is an associate editor for New York Magazine and a writer for the Daily Intelligencer blog.
I think Hillary's inevitability.
The ambitious first-term senators, Marco Rubio.
The other Bushes, he's very much an introvert.
Rand Paul, always interesting having you.
Cuban-American, young, attractive, charismatic.
A charismatic young senator is wild.
She's still Hillary the inevitable.
Hillary
and next,
Clinton's presidential announcement is polarizing California.
They might disagree. They're pretty ambitious guys themselves.
And they'll be busy too, in some ways.
Coming up, the freedom to video cops in action. It's not always guaranteed.
This is On the Media.
Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
Looking for a new show to check out? Download the latest podcast from WNYC's The Longest Shortest Time with Hillary Frank. Think of the show as your 3 a.m. bedside companion. Get The Longest Shortest Time wherever you get your podcasts or listen on the WNYC app.
This is On the Media. I'm Brooke Gladstone.
And I'm Bob Garfield. Last week, Faden Santana of South Carolina filmed the shooting of a man named Walter Scott, who was running away from a police officer. The clip has now been widely circulated, but at first, Santana was hesitant to release it. Here he's speaking with NBC News.
I even thought about erasing the video and just getting out of the community.
Leaving town?
Yes.
Because you were that scared?
Yeah.
Why was he afraid? Because, for one thing, the arrest of amateur videographers filming police activity has become commonplace. The Supreme Court has not yet ruled on the rights of civilians to record in public, leaving the matter to be handled by each jurisdiction individually. So in some parts of the country, police are arresting civilian videographers and facing no legal consequences for so doing. However, one First Circuit Court of Appeals ruling from the 2011 case Glick versus Cunniff has set a kind of precedent, ruling that, quote, open and obvious filming is a liberty safeguarded by the First Amendment. Jeff Hermes, lawyer and deputy director of the Media Law Resource Center, says the case concerns a man named Simon Glick, who, after filming police making an arrest in a Boston city park, was himself arrested and charged with wiretapping, disturbing the peace, and aiding in the escape of a prisoner. Glick filed a civil rights suit against the police, arguing that his First and Fourth Amendment rights had been violated, and the court agreed.
The Glick case was sort of a turning point because it was a very clear opinion. The First Circuit really grounded its recognition of this First Amendment right in a long tradition of First Amendment activity in public places, use of public parks, observing government officials. And so it was a very powerful statement that, yes, we should be recognizing this right. And other courts started to pick up on that in jurisdictions that didn't yet have a ruling of that nature.
Now, there is judicial precedent, and then there is life on the streets. And it doesn't matter what the law is, if a policeman decides to get in your face, that's what Faden Santana was saying before he turned over eventually the cell phone video of the Walter Scott shooting. How much should I fear as a citizen about policemen behaving with impunity while I'm simply photographing them doing their jobs and presumably badly?
Well, the first thing I'd say about that is that in the vast majority of cases, police officers are good people trying to do a difficult job under trying situations. So if you do have an officer who knows about the right to record, most of the time they're going to treat you all right. But any interaction between civilians and police in a situation in which there's an arrest, there's, you know, potentially dangerous conditions such as a traffic stop, there's some level of unpredictability. And so there can be danger where somebody is asserting rights to record while ignoring warning signs, police shouting at one another, the presence of weapons, other kinds of things that might indicate that this is a fraught situation where mistakes might be made. You mentioned the situation in South Carolina. That's another class of situation where you have somebody who's making a recording who has just witnessed a police officer acting in what can only be said as clear violation of the law. In those circumstances, you know, somebody who manages to catch a recording like that might well feel a level of justified anxiety because we've already seen the officer being recorded acting outside of proper boundaries, acting outside of their authority in a very violent manner.
And there's yet another level. There's a guy named Ramsey Orta, the civilian who, with his cell phone, captured the chokehold death of Eric Garner in Staten Island. He left the scene without being molested, but very shortly thereafter was arrested on one charge or another, and then subsequently on yet another charge, and until just a few days ago was in jail on Rikers Island, and has made the argument that his arrest had almost nothing to do with whatever mischief he was up to and everything to do with the police retaliating for putting them in an embarrassing light. Is there evidence that this kind of ex post facto harassment is taking place?
Well, we've certainly seen a number of cases in which this kind of activity has at least been alleged. There was a case down in the Western District of Texas called Buehler versus City of Austin where there was an allegation of a retaliatory arrest for exercise of First Amendment rights. I'd hesitate to say how widespread that particular kind of retaliation is, but yes, it does happen.
So tell me, Mr. Lawyer, I got a cell phone. I live in the world. If I encounter the police doing something alarming, do you have any advice for me about how to go about it and then what to do next?
Don't interfere in what the police are doing. If you're recording, make sure you're recording at a safe distance. If the police give you instructions about where to stand and where to move, those instructions might be unconstitutional. They might interfere with your right to record, but you're almost always better off in the instance obeying those instructions and then talking to a lawyer later than doing something which is going to get you arrested or have your phone seized or your footage deleted.
Now, it turns out, like so much else in this life, there's an app for that called Stop and Frisk. If you shake it like a maraca, it maracas the recorded video. You know, you're handing the phone over to the officer. Yeah, here. Here you go, officer. And before he has it in his hands or she, it is on the servers of the New York Civil Liberties Union.
A very clever application to try to work around this problem. In some circumstances, we have seen allegations of video actually being deleted by police officers. And so if that's a concern, yes, one of these measures might take care of it. But we've also seen circumstances in which the phone has been seized and returned and the video is intact. We've had circumstances where the video actually failed to record at all. But nevertheless, there was a First Amendment violation because the police officer acted to try to stop somebody from recording. So many different iterations of what can happen in these circumstances, but an app to preserve footage can be useful in some of them.
We've previously on this show reported on data that shows that the presence of video chastens everybody involved in these confrontations, both citizen subjects and police alike, and that the number of disputed incidents has gone down because everybody understands that, you know, smile, you're on candid camera.
And that's one of the major arguments in favor of, for example, police body cameras, which is a different kind of iteration of this issue. But certainly, regardless of who's holding the camera and who's operating the camera, yes, there is a civilizing effect that the lens can have on a situation.
All right. Jeff, thank you very much.
My pleasure.
Jeff Hermes is a lawyer and deputy director of the Media Law Resource Center.
The Hugo Awards are the highest honor in science fiction writing. This year, more than 2,000 ballots nominated the Hugo Award finalists, and most voted in concert with two conservative camps who call themselves the Sad Puppies and the Rabid Puppies. They contend that the Hugo Awards have fallen prey to a liberal elitist agenda. In a recent interview, Larry Correa, who helped assemble the Sad Puppies and named them, said he had to organize against the clique dominating the Hugos because it would never let him win because of his pro-gun and conservative beliefs.
a big clique of people talking about how, well, you know, we're never going to read him. He's evil. He's bad. He's a horrible person. You know, we can't have horrible people like this be recognized. He's going to end the literature forever. You know, it was absurd. But I mean, I come from a political background where you don't put up with that crap. You fight it.
So Correa and others got together to vote as a body on a chosen slate of relatively obscure nominees to make a point. And it worked. Many science fiction fans and writers, including George R.R. Martin, say the prize has been broken beyond repair, vanquished by politics. Arthur Chu, an actor, writer, and serious science fiction fan, says that the puppies freaked the Hugos, a practice of biasing polls that dates back more than a decade.
Freeping refers to the name of the website The Free Republic, the right-wing political site notorious in the past for sending groups of its members to flood polls and comment sections to provide the appearance of a very strong right-wing majority. They would say, freep this poll, and just have everyone descend on it at once.
And we've seen Stephen Colbert do similar things in messing with Wikipedia.
With Wikipedia, with getting a bridge in Hungary named after himself or a module of the ISS. A lot of people don't realize that when he was leveraging his fan base to pull these pranks, he was specifically referencing something that right-wing personalities on the internet had been doing in earnest.
So relate this freeping to the Hugo Awards. You can pay $40, join WorldCom, the Science Fiction Association, and vote for a nominee. That sounds very democratic.
Right. They've just always trusted in the past that the people who are willing to pay $40 are the people who are most invested, who have read the most during the past year, and who have the strongest, you know, best informed opinions. But that makes it very vulnerable to being gamed by people who also are willing to pay $40 because they have a political axe to grind, especially because the Hugo voting has two phases, nomination and then final voting. In nomination, any work during the whole year is eligible. So that means that people voting in good faith, not coordinating with each other, are very likely to pick a wide array of different choices, which means even a very small group that is coordinating with each other can easily dominate the nomination phase by all nominating the same set of works. And that's what's happened this year.
Isn't that what happened in 1987 when the Church of Scientology engaged in a similar tactic and signed up en masse to cast their votes for L. Ron Hubbard, who then made it onto the ballot but lost the award?
Right. The difference is with the Church of Scientology and with other authors in the past who've gotten their fans to put them on the ballot, it's always been about putting one book that everyone was backing or one person. They would be up against four other people in the finals, and then people could make a fair choice between them. What has happened this year is instead of doing that, they've coordinated to nominate the same slate across the board so that the whole category is made entirely of their candidates and everyone else is crowded out. And that leads to some pretty ridiculous results, like three of the candidates for Best Novella being written by the same person, John C. Wright.
Uh-huh. So who is John C. Wright?
He was best known originally as the author of the novel The Golden Age, part of the trilogy The Golden Acumen, a big ideas science fiction writer with right-wing political leanings. At some point, he started becoming better known for his political views than his writing. He went on a rant about how the Sci-Fi Channel was contributing to the fall of civilization by including more gay and lesbian characters on their shows. And over time, he has gotten more and more strident with putting his political views in the work. Like the Mists of Everness series interrupts what's supposedly a fantasy story taking place in a dream world to talk about why America should go back on the gold standard or why we should have nuked Moscow in the Cold War. The works that are nominated for the Hugo this year are works that I would bet very few people have read because they were published in ebook form by a micro publisher based in Finland called Castalia House.
Why did the sad and rabid puppies pick Castalia House?
Well, Castalia House is owned by a guy named Theodore Beale, who goes by the pen name Vox Day. The only regular member of the Science Fiction and Fantasy Writers of America to be expelled from the organization.
Why?
He was expelled because he used the Science Fiction and Fantasy Writers of America Twitter to post a link to a blog post where he called an African-American author, N.K. Jemisin, a half-savage. He was making the argument that people of other races are, you know, not fully civilized and that therefore they're not capable of doing the work necessary to sustain a genre of literature like science fiction, that white men created the genre and white men have to continue to sustain it.
He's the guy who said that the Taliban's shooting of Malala Yousafzai was perfectly rational and scientifically justifiable. You say that Vox Day is on pretty much every list there is of hate speech radicals on the internet.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. In fact, it's quite likely if you have a work filter on your computer that his blog will be filtered out. It's on several such lists.
So his publishing house got 9 nominations through this sort of freeping enterprise.
Yes, plus a 10th nomination for Vox Day himself as best editor.
You've likened the Sad and Rabid Puppies to Gamergate, which refers to a very active group of video game fans battling what they see as the same liberal feminine creep into their medium. They send death threats to female game designers. They harry female game reviewers offline. Are they, in fact, the same people?
Some of them are the same people. Vox Day, in particular, is in pretty much every one of these movements. The two things that are the same within this movement and other similar movements are, like, one, this sense of entitlement that so-called gamers think that the whole medium of interactive computer entertainment belongs to them because they were there first. They're the core audience. And it's the same kind of elitism in the Sad Puppies movement. It's a weird thing. They talk about being populist, but when they talk about what really makes them mad about the elite they think run things now, it's always, oh, they don't know Asimov, they don't know Heinlein. The repeated refrain is Robert Heinlein couldn't win a Hugo today because he was too politically conservative. And it's really just that the genre as a whole has moved beyond people like Robert Heinlein and Isaac Asimov. And yet they're convinced that if you don't know this canon, you're not really a science fiction fan.
You suggest that the fervent hate of disco by rock-loving young white men in the 1970s was sort of a precursor to what we're seeing now. Tell me about Disco Demolition Night.
Right. That was a riot that took place in Chicago.
This was on July 12th, 1979.
Mm-hmm. There was a local DJ who was riling up anti-disco sentiment for fun, for ratings, getting his listeners to, like, go to disco concerts and yell stuff at the stage, and eventually, you know, they gathered all these disco records, piled them up, and blew them up with explosives. People have stories about being beaten up because they listen to disco. You don't get that level of vitriol just from, like, simple musical taste. It stands for something else. Disco was music that was embraced by the gay community. Disco was music that was embraced by the black community. Disco was music that was seen as, you know, less American, less masculine. The backlash, the anger when a culture starts changing and it's changing in favor of some minority group, that you feel like what you have is being threatened. And often it's coded in gender. Disco is girly. These new indie games, the core gamers don't like, they're girly. They're games about relationships and they're games about, you know, literary metaphors and poetry. And the fear of emasculation is such, like, a central psychological thing in these backlashes. It has to be something that deep. And the fear of emasculation runs pretty deep in our culture in order to evoke that kind of violence.
Cameron Hurley, a Hugo winner and frequent nominee, noted that last year, work by women and people of color swept the Nebula Awards in addition to the Hugos. And partly that's because our demographics are shifting and our politics are too. For instance, 61% of young Republicans favor gay marriage. But Hurley says that the Sad Puppies and their counterparts in gaming and comics still matter despite these demographics, because those genres explore what possible world we could build.
Right. Science fiction is supposed to be a genre about the future, but so frequently it's about our anxieties about the future and trying to cling to the past. If you read a lot of Golden Age science fiction, it's about positing a world where we have spaceships, where we have, you know, faster than light travel and artificially intelligent computers, but women are still the secretaries and men are still the adventurers. These social things, gender roles, social class, capitalism don't change. It's just the trappings of our technology change. Genuine social change is actually actively scary to a lot of people who like the science fiction genre because of its message of stability, of unchangingness, ironically enough.
We can see it as a symbol for what's going on across culture generally. What is the next thing that's going to go?
In Gamergate, they keep talking about spreading to other media, you know, Comicsgate, Metalgate, about heavy metal music. They do see it as an all-encompassing culture war.
This movement of puppies presents themselves as underdogs. And maybe it's because last year women and people of color swept the science fiction awards. Maybe they are the underdogs because they can't win. You know, they can destroy every award that can be freaked, but fundamentally, culture is going to be decided by groups of people in the marketplace who far outnumber these engaged communities.
But at the same time, they can do a lot of damage in the short term. Loud, powerful, scary voices can intimidate people. Comics was stuck in that mode for a long time. All the time, people who were in charge in comics were like, this industry can't survive if it's the same small clique of, you know, aging white men who have read comics since they were kids. We've got to get new blood. Meanwhile, you have this instant outcry from the old hardcore fans who've kind of got a death grip.
But now you have a Jewish thing and you have a black Captain America and a disco song recently at the top of the charts.
Won the Grammy for best song. Yeah. And we've got a Muslim woman, Ms. Marvel, is the best-selling comic book right now. So these things change. You hit a turning point at some point. In a sense, they are the underdogs. In another sense, they're just being asked to share, to acknowledge they're a minority. It's not like what they want will disappear. I can go get old school comics about guys blowing things up easily. Now it's just that that's increasingly a niche. They don't own the whole market. And the fear of being irrelevant is, I think, the thing that drives them, not the fear of not having something to read.
Arthur, thank you very much.
Thank you.
Arthur Chu is an actor and writer on culture and society.
Coming up, guess who's coming to dinner? A new documentary documents White House correspondents not corresponding.
This is On the Media.
At Radiolab, we love nothing more than nerding out about science, neuroscience, chemistry.
But we do also like to get into other kinds of stories. Stories about policing. Or
politics.
Country music.
Hockey.
Sex. Of bugs.
Regardless of whether we're looking at science or not science, we bring a rigorous curiosity to get you the answers.
And hopefully make you see the world anew.
Radiolab, adventures on the edge of what we think we know.
Wherever you get your podcasts.
If you're a parent or considering becoming a parent, check out WNYC's The Longest Shortest Time with Hillary Frank. It is totally different from any other parenting media out there. No tips, no judgment, just great stories. And you don't even have to be a parent to like it. The Longest Shortest Time takes a diverse look at the realities of parenthood and of growing up, from how one's childhood informs one's own parenting or how to get your sex life back after becoming a mommy or daddy. Get The Longest Shortest Time wherever you get your podcasts or listen on the WNYC app.
This is On the Media. I'm Brooke Gladstone.
And I'm Bob Garfield. Spring is here, and with it so many familiar spectator events. The Kentucky Derby, the Indianapolis 500, the Pope's Easter Message in St. Peter's Square, and most important of all, or at least most self-important, the White House Correspondents' Dinner. Nominally about raising funds for journalism scholarships and celebrating the hard work of the press corps, it has metastasized into a weekend of hobnobbing, shrimp eating, and celebrity spotting, all documented in a new film called Nerd Prom: Inside Washington's Wildest Week. Once, filmmaker Patrick Gavin was himself a political journalist who had spent more than one April Saturday at that dinner chasing down the stories wherever they led him.
I was that person on the red carpet asking really dumb questions of celebrities or politicians. Yeah, that was me.
Well, it wasn't as though they were trivial questions of insignificant personages. I mean, it's not as though you were flagging down Kim Kardashian. Oh, wait a second. Yes, it was.
Kim, are you excited for your first White House Correspondents' Dinner?
Very excited.
You know, most celebrities will stop to talk to you, but she was at a different level. She just kind of did a drive-by and moved on.
The Correspondents' Dinner is a charity event. It raises money for a good cause, scholarships to journalism school for promising students. And up to $100,000 worth of tuition is paid for that night, which is great.
But it just seems to me that if you're paying your CEO, the executive director of the White House Correspondents Association, more than you're giving away in scholarships, that's a bad ratio no matter how you look at it. And sadly, it actually went down this year. So reaching out to all these news organizations that do throw parties, you know, from CNN to Yahoo to the New Republic, and just saying, you know, what about $5,000, you know, $10,000? They don't even bother to ask, which struck me as really odd.
But let's not dwell on dollars and cents, Patrick. I mean, to sit there in the audience and watch the hush fall over the crowd when yet another young journalist is honored.
Would those of you in the ballroom please wait just a moment? In fairness to the guests that we have here tonight, those of you in the back who continue to talk made it impossible for our scholarship students to even hear their names called.
That was ABC's Ann Compton, her head just about exploding at the rudeness and indifference. You also point out something I witnessed and was appalled by myself in the George W. Bush administration, Ray Charles performing one of his last major public appearances. And the subject is kind of shooting fish in a barrel, and I can say that comfortably because last year we took out a shotgun and did that very thing. And when Mark Leibovich's book, This Town, came out, he went after the White House Correspondents' Dinner. And yet I'm quite sure this weekend is going to be the biggest one ever. People acknowledge the problem, and then, you know, they put on their tux or gown.
I do think it'll be curbed. I think that there's, from Tom Brokaw a couple of years ago to Mark's book to this movie to just general criticism, it does seem as if it's becoming a lot less cool to kind of be a fanboy for this weekend. When people sort of say, yeah, it's this kind of gross weekend, but it is what it is, so what? That's just a level of cynicism I don't think I'm at yet. I mean, this town has a 10% approval rating, politicians and reporters alike. And for people to say that our biggest moment is kind of gross, but we shouldn't care, it's just that was very, very discomforting for me to hear that.
Well, if we've established that the White House Correspondents' Weekend is about almost everything but White House correspondents, what, pray tell, now that you have immersed yourself in this subject, is it all about?
I think at this point it's just a big business conference. It's a way for people in Washington to sell themselves, to sell their brand, to establish where they fall in the pecking order. For people outside of Washington, it is probably the single best opportunity to lobby and influence. So it's certainly moved a long way away from the work of White House correspondents, and it's basically turned into a multi-million dollar business opportunity for lots of people.
What would you do to restore some semblance of relevance and dignity and, let's just say, ethical soundness to the whole affair?
You could get rid of the red carpet. You could strengthen the scholarship program by asking people from news organizations to contribute more to it. You know, I think the president should skip it once in a while, because the only reason that most of those celebrities are there is for the opportunity to see the president. They're flying to D.C. not knowing whether or not the president will show up. They're probably not going to come to D.C. You know, so that's the real micro stuff. But I think that on the macro level, I don't blame the dinner. I don't necessarily blame even people throwing parties. If this was number 9 on our list of exciting events every year, and the first 8 were the passage of a really meaningful piece of legislation or a climate change rally or a Tea Party event or, you know, something that kind of honed more closely to what the city was about, I would have no problem with this dinner, even in its current manifestation. I just don't like how people have made it our number one event.
Patrick, thank you very much.
Thank you so much. I appreciate it.
Patrick Gavin, until recently, was a reporter for Politico. He is the writer, director, and star of Nerd Prom, Inside Washington's Wildest Week. You can find the film at nerdpromthemovie.com. Now, as previously alluded to, Gavin is by no means the first to raise his eyebrows about the vulgarity and hypocrisy of the correspondence dinner. In fact, last year, OTM itself dispatched its senior surrendering all dignity correspondent to Washington to report from the front lines, just behind the E! Entertainment Television camera emplacement.
These days, the House Republicans actually give John Boehner a harder time than they give me. Which means orange really is the new black.
That was Barack Obama 10 minutes into his monologue at the 2014 White House Correspondents' Dinner, ridiculing the permatan of his political nemesis. It was an almost perfect joke, just like the White House Correspondents' Dinner itself. Almost everything you need to know about the Correspondents' Dinner is that there is a red carpet. That hollering is the working press, cordoned behind retractable belt barriers, here vying for the attention of, I swear to God, Greta Van Susteren. Yeah, I was penned in there too. You know, journalizing, just like my colleagues.
Hi, I'm Bob Garfield from On the Media. What story are you chasing tonight?
Oh, we're just talking to celebs, seeing why they're here, just chatting.
Your news organization?
I'm with USA Today.
What do you hear after today?
Fun moments on the red carpet, trying to mix the fun of the politicians with the crazy of the celebrities.
Who are you?
I'm with ABC.
On the Media is hosting a media ethics colloquy at 7 tonight. You guys interested?
Well, right now I'm zipping back. I'm only here for part-time. I'm handing this off, so.
More on that media ethics thing in a minute. But I will say that the red carpet delivered these folks their stars. CNN's Suzanne Malveaux chatted up Scandal's Scott Foley.
That it is so incredible because nobody thought that the White House administration could be that scandalous or that sexy.
Well, that's scandalous or sexy. Thank you.
Someone snagged one of the Duck Dynasty guys.
I think everybody's just looking around. I'm staring at everybody around me.
And check out Uzo Adubo of Orange is the New Black.
Is there anyone here that you're trying to, like, casually stand next to and talk to?
I'm trying to casually stand next to Kevin Hart. I also would like to very casually and or aggressively be next to Wolf Blitzer from CNN.
I know, right?
You look lovely as always, Wolf. Who are you wearing?
Armani.
Well done. What's the what story are you chasing tonight?
I'm not chasing anything. We're here to have fun.
Correct. CNN hosted New Jersey Governor Chris Christie, Texas Governor Rick Perry, a White House special assistant, and a couple of members of Congress. CBS had HUD Secretary Sean Donovan. The Washington Post had Transportation's Anthony Fox. Yahoo News had Attorney General Eric Holder. ABC had Homeland Security Secretary Jay Johnson, whose department routinely ignores press questions about detaining and abusing American citizens at the border, and lethal force against unarmed suspects. But Johnson and the others sat there in their tuxedos, offering nothing more to their news organization hosts than the basket of dinner rolls, in no jeopardy whatsoever of journalism breaking out. In the week leading up to the event, I asked Steve Tama, president of the Correspondents Association, about the propriety of cozying up to the very officials his membership is supposed to be watchdogging.
Every reporter in this town who covers a beat, we all take people out to lunch or dinner, either because we're already talking to them every day or we're hoping they'll return our calls and talk every day. And I just don't have a problem with it. It's up to every journalist what they do with their source. We're just not going to get involved in that relationship.
Abusive though it may be. This is an administration that has systematically stiffed the press corps for 7 years. Access is so bad, the press usually can't even take photos at photo ops. Saturday's dinner, putting reporters face-to-face with Obama for 5 solid hours, was by far their longest presidential encounter of the year. Yet, of course, not one question about Ukraine, immigration, the Keystone XL pipeline, the budget, the NSA, the climate, the Mideast peace process, or anything else.
As for everyday opportunities to see the president, Tom assured me that objections of the Correspondents Association and its allies have been duly registered at the White House.
And we believe we have made some progress, particularly for the cameras, for photojournalists. We think that we're getting them in more often than we used to.
A lot of progress?
Some progress.
Significant progress?
We'll get to significant progress.
In the Hilton Grand Ballroom, the sound of shoulders rubbing. Up on the second floor was the sound of crickets chirping. As dinner convened downstairs, On the Media did indeed host an ethics colloquy that we named Red Carpets and Red Flags, featuring American University journalism professor Patricia Afterheide, Jeffrey Goldberg of Bloomberg News, my fixer Mark Leibovich of the New York Times Magazine, and me. Refreshments were served to us because nobody else showed up.
So you think people are going to come? Where did you put the poster?
This thing's been a complete flop. I mean, it's looked a little bit demoralizing.
I think we can call it. It's 7:25.
It's been great, guys.
Yeah, you want to take some donuts with you?
I actually took them back with me, back beyond the Beltway where this expedition started. Although, truth be told, after seeing the workings of media and official Washington firsthand, I'd pretty much lost my appetite.
Washington, D.C. is paradise to me. It's not because it is the grand old seat of precious freedom and democracy. No, no, no.
That's it for this week's show. On the Media is produced by Meera Sharma, Kimmy Regler, Alana Katsanova-Burgess, Kasia Mihailovich, and Jesse Brenneman. We had more help from Ethan Scheel and Jenna Cagle, and our show was edited by Brooke. Our technical director is Jennifer Munson. Our engineer this week was Greg Rippon.
Katya Rogers is our executive producer. Jim Schachter is WNYC's vice president for news. Bassist composer Ben Allison wrote our theme. On the Media is produced by WNYC and distributed by NPR. I'm Brooke Gladstone.
And I'm Bob Garfield.
Support for On the Media comes from the John D. and Catherine T. MacArthur Foundation, the Ford Foundation, the Overbrook Foundation, and the listeners of WNYC Radio. This is NPR.